We present Rites of Passage by William Golding, adapted for radio by Don Taylor. With Samuel West as Edmund Talbot. Episode 2.
Your Lordship's request that I should keep a journal of my journey to the Antipodes has proved a stranger and more demanding task than I could have imagined. Something has happened on this ship that I do not understand. Something to do with our grim-faced Captain Anderson, the obsequious Parson Colley, and the ship's officers. In particular, something happened during last evening's entertainment produced by the ship's people. Lieutenant Summers fired a blunderbuss over the side for no apparent reason. And shortly after, I found Lieutenant Deverell laughing drunk in the saloon with a carnival mask in his hand. Then this morning, Colley thanked me with embarrassing effusiveness merely for speaking to him. I cannot simply request the answers to these mysteries without revealing the cause of my ignorance, but I was in my cabin pleasantly preoccupied with Miss Zenobia Brocklebank at the time. I shall go into the lobby and see what I can find out by listening to casual conversations.
Mr. Talbot!
Miss Brocklebank!
Edmund!
How may I serve you, madam?
A letter! Oh, God! What shall I do?
Zenobia, tell me all.
Oh, heavens, it is a B.A. Lost! Lost!
But, my dear, I've written you nothing.
It was from another.
Well, I refuse to be responsible for every gentleman in the ship. You should employ his offices, not mine. And so...
The note is wholly innocent, but might be misunderstood. I may have dropped it. Oh, Edmund, you know where.
I assure you that while I rearranged my hutch where it had been disturbed by a certain exquisite occasion, I should have noticed...
Please, oh, please, it must be in your cabin. Should Wheeler find it, I am lost.
Ah, yes, Wheeler. Say no more, Miss Brocklebank, I shall look at once.
Thank you, sir.
What the devil can it be? The cabin is small enough in all conscience, and I have necessarily rearranged every object within it.
Sir?
Wheeler.
Are you in need of anything, sir?
No. Go away, Wheeler. Go away.
Right, sir.
A few minutes later, when I was about to pour water into my canvas basin, what did I see in the center of it but a piece of paper folded? It could not have been there before. Even if I had overlooked it in my search, I had performed my ablutions in the basin that morning. It could only have been Wheeler.
My hand is uneducated. Barely literate.
Dearest, most adorable woman, I can wait no longer. I have at last discovered a place and no one is in the know. My heart thunders in my bosom as it never did in my frequent hours of peril. Only acquaint me with the time and I will conduct you to our heaven. Your sailor hero.
Good God, the whole thing's descending into farce. Can hardly be Deverell. Wheeler!
Yes, sir!
You have been busy in my cabin.
What should I do without you?
Sir, I'm pleased with your attentiveness. Here is a half guinea for you. You are sometimes forgetful, though, are you not?
Thank you, Mr. Talbot. You may rely on me in every way, sir.
After I had rid myself of the B.A. by the simple expedient of knocking on the door of Miss Zenobia's hutch, she opened it, I handed her the note and left, I went up onto the quarterdeck for air.
Good morning, Mr. Deverell.
Good morning, Mr. Talbot.
Our friend Prettyman still parades determinedly with Brocklebank's blunderbuss, I see.
He has not shot his albatross yet.
Indeed. I cannot be convinced he is any danger to the state, though. What would he do?
Not on board this ship.
No, Mr. Deverell, I would hope not. Good morning, Prettyman. Still on patrol?
Look down there, sir. In the waist.
Good Lord, that's Collie. In full fig. Surplice, hood, gown and all.
What more can we call it than a superstitious and barbaric finery?
Only primitive and uncivilized people worship such trappings.
It is the ceremonial dress of the established church, sir. Why is he wearing it today?
Look at him. He's not walking. He is processing, as though he were in a cathedral, not at sea.
Good God, he's crossing the white line.
That white line, sir, dividing our brothers and sisters in the forward parts of this ship from our privileged selves, is an insult to all reasonable people. I ignore such demarcation, sir, on principle.
Collie doesn't. He's going into the forecastle. What on earth is he going to do there? Preach a sermon?
For a time, I do not know how long, I waited to see what would happen. But nothing happened, and I returned to my cabin to continue with this journal. I broke off writing when I heard an extraordinary noise. It came from the forecastle, so I once again went out on deck. I thought I could just hear the reverend gentleman speaking. I had half a mind to conceal myself by the break of the forecastle and listen. But then I reflected on the number of sermons I had heard in my life, and the likely number to come. I was about to return to my cabin when I heard it again. I do not have to point out to your lordship the rarity of the occasions when a sermon is applauded, and with an applause that would have seemed more proper for an entertainment. What was Collie doing? Keeping 6 dinner plates in the air at once, with a billiard cue balanced on his forehead and a chamber pot revolving on the top of it.
Mr. Talbert?
Mr. Deverell?
I'm just off watch and going to take a tot in the saloon. Will you join me?
Yes, sir, I will.
I wonder what on earth Miss Brocklebank is discussing with Mr. Prettyman.
I haven't noticed.
Why, there she is indeed. I can't imagine that she's at all interested in the principles of the revolutionary friend.
I'm sure that Mr. Prettyman will lecture to any audience available, whether it listens or not.
2 brandies, Bates?
Yes, sir.
She is a woman of the most generous disposition. I'm sure she will listen, whatever is said.
And of a most theatrical conversation, too. Any rencounter with her is conducted in such melodramatic terms one might think oneself on stage.
You have felt that, too?
I have had some discussions with her. As with the other passengers, we are all sure to become well known to each other on such a long voyage.
Oh, yes, sir, we shall. 2 brandies,
sir.
Thank you, Bates. I, too, have found her conversation diverting at times.
It is inconsequential, I find. Of no great weight.
Yes, let us hope so. But her conversational manners are not a subject for public discussion, I think.
Indeed not. I share that opinion.
Well, excuse me now, sir. I must be about my business. A pleasure to talk to you. As always, Mr. Talbert.
Your servant, sir.
I was on my way back to my hutch when I was once again stopped in my tracks. What was going on in the forecastle? I could not imagine Collie as a wit, and concluded that they must be mocking him, like schoolboys who, when the master has left them, mimic and pantomime his rebuke. I went up onto the quarterdeck for a better view, but could see no one on the forecastle except the lookout. They were all inside. But word had flown round the ship. The afterdeck and quarterdeck were filling with all the ladies and gentlemen and officers, like the audience at a theatre.
Something very funny going on up there, by the sound of the laughs it's getting.
Is this quite proper, Mr. Prettyman?
If it is not Miss Granham, we shall know who to blame.
Now for some action. There's some smart young fellow. Now, what was that all about?
At the height of the laughter, 2 young ship's boys had shot out of the forecastle door on the larboard side and sped across the deck behind the mainmast into the similar door to starboard. Then, Mr. Summers appeared, running.
Captain Anderson!
Well, Mr. Summers!
I beg you will allow me to take charge, sir.
We must not interfere with the church, Mr. Summers.
Sir, the men, sir.
Well, sir!
They are in drink.
Then see that they are punished for it, Mr. Summers. Good day to you, Mr. Talbot. I trust you are enjoying our progress in these equatorial climes.
Indeed I am, sir, though it is somewhat hot. You seem to thrive on it, sir.
It is my profession, sir.
Captain, at least allow me...
What, sir?
Ah, sir, look at that.
All's well!
2 more figures were processing across the deck from door to door. Over their sailor's canvas, one wore a black fur hood, surely Collie's, over his head. and minced with one hand on his hip and elbow akimbo. The other wore a mortarboard and followed in shambling pursuit. There was no doubt about it. This play-acting was not solely for the inmates of the forecastle. It was directed at us.
There is a spirit of anarchy abroad, Mr. Prettyman.
It may be, madam. It may be.
You speak with enthusiasm, sir.
Have we not seen sufficient example of indiscipline among the Gallic race to deplore it in the forecastle?
Liberty is not indiscipline, sir. Quite the opposite.
But our debate was cut short by the appearance of Mr. Tommy Taylor.
Mr. Summers, sir.
More decorum about the deck, young fellow.
Mr. Cumfrey, sir. I must see the first lieutenant, sir. It's true. It's God's my judge.
Swearing again, are you, you little sod?
It's the parson, sir. I told you it was.
Mr. Colley, to you, sir, and damn your impudence for a squeaking little bugger.
It's true, sir. Mr. Colley's in there, in the forecastle, as drunk as a butcher's boot.
Get below, sir, or I'll masthead you.
Better than Drury Lane, it is.
Oh, Pa, you think we shall see him?
I think, Mr. Prettyman, I shall go below to my cabin.
Miss Granham, do you not want to see the catastrophe?
No, Mr. Prettyman, I do not.
Then I'll accompany you below, ma'am.
And for a few minutes, there was what can only be described as an expectant silence. And then, the distant sound of a man's voice.
Billy boy, where have you been all the day? My Billy boy. The merry month of May, he laid me down upon my back, and then I heard him say...
Mr. Devereaux! Yes, sir! Be good enough to have the parson informed. He must now return to his cabin.
Mr. Taylor, run and tell the parson he must go below.
Yes, sir.
There was some confused shouting and laughter as Mr. Taylor disappeared into the forecastle. And then what sounded for all the world like a string of endearments from Mr. Colley. Then Mr. Taylor came stumbling out, and the parson appeared. His ecclesiastical garments had gone. His very breeches, stockings, and shoes had been taken from him. Some charitable soul had supplied him with a sailor's loose canvas garment, which, because of his diminutive stature, was sufficient to cover his loins. A sturdy young seaman had charge of him, supporting the parson's head on his breast. The expression on Collie's face was one of the most extreme and sunny enjoyment.
Joy! Joy! Joy!
Then he turned to his right, walked slowly to the bulwark, and pissed against it.
Blessing of God the Father Almighty, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost, be with you and remain with you always.
Finish! Help me get him below.
Yes, sir.
All right, sailor, you can go forward.
Aye, aye, sir.
Well, Captain, you're to be complimented. I ain't seen a better show in years.
Something like a smile passed over the captain's customarily grim jaw. Far from dismissing the passengers from his quarterdeck, he was almost sociable. There was a lightness of step and eye about him. He was pleased. This is the 51st day of our voyage, I think. Nothing has happened since Collie entertained us. He is much condemned. Captain Anderson continues benign. Collie himself has not been out of his hutch in the 4 days since his drunkenness. But I have spoken with Lieutenant Deverell in the saloon again.
It is a kind of country dance, sir, do you not think? Circle and change partners.
Take me with you, sir.
With the lady being passed from hand to hand along the
line? Ah, yes, and you have been part of this dance, if I'm not mistaken.
As you have.
I fear so.
Though, if I may pass on to you the latest step or figure, I think Cumbersham is now the man.
Good God. Will she enlist the whole ship?
And
Have you seen Mrs. Brocklebank? She has finally emerged on deck, and she is younger than Zenobia. You're not suggesting. Indeed, I am. Brocklebank runs them both. At least he has the decency to have the so-called mother and the so-called daughter in different cabins.
The devil. Well, Cumbersham's welcome to her.
I must own I am not unhappy at the fact. I had feared a certain difficulty.
A consequence, so had I.
But the division by two or three or however large the number gives the answer zero, I think. Not good mathematics, but good sense.
I have to tell you, sir, that I had an even more ridiculous idea. It was my plan, following Shakespeare, to pair her off with Collie. What a Beatrice and Benedict they would have made, eh?
Well, damn me, sir!
Sir, this is a little offensive, I think.
No, dear sir. I ask your pardon for any offence, but the coincidence is past the wit of man to invent.
What coincidence?
I will share the jest with you if you will give me your sworn pardon never to repeat it.
Of course, sir.
Well, the fact is... we have company, sir, and I am due on watch in a few moments. We shall share it another time.
So one thing I think is sure, Devereux is not Miss Brocklebank's sailor hero. So who the devil is? Perhaps the jest he was about to break with me would have made that too clear. As your lordship will notice, I have been remiss and let several days go past without attending to the journal. I have felt a lethargy, there being little to do but walk the deck and drink and speak with anyone who will. But I have today had a conversation with Summers, which is worth your lordship's notice.
You have had some talk with Mr. Devereux, I believe, sir.
I have. Mr. Devereux is a gentleman, but if you will allow me to say it, you are the better officer, and I suspect the better man.
That is a compliment indeed.
Sir, I hope I've not offended you.
Mr. Talbot, I do not know how to say this, or indeed whether I should. You make it plain that a man's original is branded on his forehead, never to be removed.
Come, Mr. Summers, I did not say it.
Do you not remember?
Remember what?
Well, why should you remember?
What, sir?
Well, Summers, allow me to congratulate you on imitating to perfection the manners and speech of a somewhat higher station than the one you were born to.
I ask your pardon, Mr. Summers. That was insufferable.
But true, sir. In our country, for all her greatness, there is one thing she cannot do, and that is translate a person wholly out of one class into another. Perfect translation from one language to another is impossible. Class is the British language.
Sir, perfect translation from one language to another is possible. I could give you an example. So is perfect translation from one class to another.
Imitating to perfection.
Perfect in this, that you are a gentleman.
Well, sir.
Yet you see, my dear fellow, we have at least one example among us where the translation is not a success.
You mean Mr. Colley? It was my intention to raise that subject.
But the man has stepped out of his station without the merit to support the elevation.
I do not see how his conduct can be traced to his origin. We do not know what it is.
But it is obvious in his physique, his speech... above all, in his habit of subordination. I swear, he has got out of the peasantry by greasy obsequiousness. Now, Bates, the brandy over here.
Yes, sir.
I can drink brandy as long as you please, but no man, and certainly no lady, will ever see in me the kind of behaviour with which Collie has affronted us. Plied, I suppose, with spirits in the forecastle, Collie had neither the strength to refuse nor the breeding to resist its destructive effects.
This wisdom should be put in a book.
Laugh, if you will, sir. Today I cannot be offended with you.
The matter I wanted to raise is that we have no physician aboard, and the man is mortally ill.
Surely not. Then he is young and suffering from overindulgence, that's all.
Still? I have talked with Phillips and seen for myself. The bed is filthy, yet the man, though he breathes now and then, does not stir. His face is hidden. He lies on his stomach, one hand above his head and clutched into the bolster, the other clutching an old ring bolt left in the timber.
A marvel you can eat after it.
I tried to turn him over.
Well, you must have succeeded. You have 3 times his strength.
Not in these circumstances. He has a strange power. The hand that holds the ring bolt might be made of steel. He lies drawn down into his bunk as made of lead.
There he must stay, then.
Is that all, Mr. Talbot? Are you as indifferent to the man's fate as others are?
I am not an officer in this ship.
The more able to help, sir.
How?
I may speak freely, I suppose. How has the man been treated?
At first, as an object of one man's dislike, then of general indifference that was leading to contempt even before this latest escapade.
What I say now could well ruin me if I'd misjudged your character.
My character, sir? You have examined my character.
Forgive me. Nothing is further from my mind than offending you, and if I did not believe the case desperate...
What case, for God's sake, that I have anything to do with?
Your birth, your prospective position. Men and women will flatter you in hope of gaining the governor's ear.
Good God, Mr. Summers.
Understand me, Mr. Talbot, I do not complain.
You sound uncommonly like a man complaining, sir.
Sir, please.
Proceed, then, if you must.
I do not speak on my own behalf. Sir, you have used your birth and your prospective position to get for yourself an unusual degree of attention and comfort. I do not complain, dare not. Who am I to question the customs of our society, or indeed the laws of nature? You have exercised the privileges of your position. I am asking you to shoulder its responsibilities.
That was a notable impertinence, Mr. Summers. Well, let me think. Steward, another brandy here.
Yes, sir.
A visit from you, sir.
I? Go in that stinking hole?
There is a phrase that suits your situation, sir. It is noblesse oblige.
Oh, be damned to your French, Summers. But I tell you this, and make what you choose of it. I believe in fair play.
That I am prepared to accept.
That is profoundly generous of you, sir. Well, Mr. Summers, you were right, were you not? I have been remiss. But those who administer correction out of school must not expect to be thanked for it.
I fear not.
Fear nothing, man. How small do you think I am? Your precious career is safe enough with me. I do not care to be lumped in with the enemy.
The company made it impossible to say more, so I went back to the lobby at once.
Wheeler, tell Mr. Collins, sir, I want to see him.
What do you want to see him for, sir?
Don't argue with me, man. Do as you're told.
Yes, sir. You want anything, sir?
Ah, yes. Phillips, I shall pay a call on Mr. Colley. I do not wish to be offended by the sights and smells of a sick room. Be good enough to clean the place up and the bunk.
I thought for a moment he might demur, but he thought better of it and withdrew. It must have been a full hour before he tapped on my door.
Yes. I've done the best I could, sir.
Thank you. What do you want, Wheeler?
I don't want anything, sir.
Do you have to hunt in pairs?
No, sir. Begging your pardon, sir.
Now then, Phillips.
Oh. Best I could do without moving him, sir.
Couldn't you have moved him?
No, sir. It's like he's locked, sir. Mr. Colley. Mr. Colley, sir. Some days ago I desired further acquaintance with you, but you have not appeared. That was too bad, sir. Might I not expect your company on deck today? Well, sir, if not today, then when you are ready. I will await you. Pray call on me.
I looked round the cabin, which was a mirror image of mine. A Bible, a prayer book, Baxter's The Saint's Everlasting Rest, and a pile of manuscript on the flap of the table. I closed the door and went back to my hutch.
By God, it'll serve me right if he takes up the offer. Is that you, Wheeler?
No, sir, it's Summers.
So you are keeping an eye on me, too?
No, sir.
I don't know whom they are more closely observing, me or each other.
Well, Mr. Talbot?
I got no response. But I have visited him, and I have discharged those responsibilities you were so kind as to bring to my notice. I can do no more.
So?
Summers? My dear Summers, do you usually move about the ship with a brandy glass in your hand? You've taken to drink. You need more practice, man. Join Deverell and me in the saloon sometime.
Mr. Talbot, you said that today you could not be angry with me. You were joking, but it was the word of a gentleman. Now I am to come at you again.
I am weary of the whole subject.
I assure you, Mr. Talbot, this is my last.
Say what you have to say, then.
Who is responsible for the man's state?
Collie? Devil take it himself. Let us not mince round the truth like a couple of church spinsters. You are going to spread the responsibility, are you not? You will include the captain, and I agree. Who else? Cumbersham? Deverell? Yourself? The starboard watch? The world?
I will be plain, sir. The best medicine for Mr. Collie will be a visit from the captain, of whom he stands in such awe. The only man with sufficient influence to bring the captain to such an action is yourself.
Then the devil take it again, for I shall not.
You said I would spread the responsibility. You are the man most responsible.
Christ in heaven, Summers, you are the man.
Wait!
Are you drunk?
I will stand shot, sir, though my career is now in far more danger from you than it ever was from the French. They could do no more than kill or maim.
You are drunk. You must be.
Had you not outfaced our captain on his own quarterdeck, had you not made use of your own rank and prospects to strike a blow at the very foundations of his authority, all this might not have happened. He is brusque, and he detests the clergy. He makes no secret of it. Had you not acted as you did, he would not have crushed Collie and continued to humiliate him because he could not humiliate you.
If Collie had had the sense to read Anderson's standing orders...
You are a passenger. Did you read them? Did you read them, Mr. Talbot?
No.
The captain's standing orders may seem as brusque to you as he is, sir, but they are wholly necessary. Those applying to the passengers are as urgent as the rest.
Very well, very well.
You have not seen a ship at a moment of crisis, sir. A ship may be taken flat aback and sunk all in a few moments. Ignorant passengers stumbling in the way, delaying an order or making it in
you
order...
You have said enough!
I hope so.
You are quite certain I'm responsible for nothing else? Mrs. East's miscarriage, perhaps?
If the captain could be induced to befriend a sick man...
Why are you so curious about Collie, Summers?
Fair play. Noblesse oblige. My education is not like yours, sir. It has been strictly practical. But I know a term under which both phrases might be... What is the word? Subsumed. I hope you will find it, sir.
He went quickly out of my hutch, leaving me somewhere between anger, embarrassment, and amusement at having been taught two lessons in one day by the same schoolmaster. What was the word he had in mind? Duty? He is as good a translation into a gentleman as your Racine is into English, my lord, if he can teach me that. Since this whole ship seems to be a kind of theatre, his role is surely that of the good man. What am I to say to Anderson? How am I to approach him? I got up at grey dawn and walked the deck trying to decide. There was no doubt the wretched Collie had made a cake of himself, nor that Anderson had persecuted him. There was a word that could sum up Summer's noblesse oblige and my fair play. That word was justice. And a way of proceeding suggested itself. I returned to my cabin, washed, shaved, and dressed with care, ready for my interview with the captain. He was walking on the windward side of the quarterdeck, exercising his captain's privilege in that as in other matters. I stationed myself on the opposite side. My hope was that he would address me.
A fine day for you, Mr. Talbot.
Indeed it is, sir. Do we make as much progress as is common in these latitudes?
I doubt that we shall achieve more than an average of a knot over the next day or two.
24 sea miles a day.
Just so, sir. Warships are generally slower than most people suppose.
Well, sir, I must confess to finding these latitudes more agreeable than any I have experienced. Could we but tow the British Isles to this part of the world, how many of our social problems would be solved? The mango would fall into our mouths.
You have a quaint fancy there, sir. Do you mean to include Ireland?
No, sir. I would offer her to the United States of America, sir.
Let them have first refusal, eh, Mr. Talbot? It would remove half a watch of my crew at a blow.
Well worth the loss, sir. What a noble prospect the ocean is under a low sun.
I am so accustomed to the sight, I do not see it. I am grateful to the oceans for another quality.
No, that is?
Their power of isolating a man from his fellows.
Of isolating a captain, sir. The rest of humanity at sea must live only too much herded. The effect on them is not of the best. Circe's pigs,
were, you remember, sailors.
The animals, I heard it, sir, not the men.
Packed together, perhaps I ought to have said. But how balmy the air is. Seems almost insupportable that I must descend again and busy myself with my journal.
You keep a journal?
It is partly an amusement, Captain, and partly a duty. It is, I suppose, what you would call a log.
You must find little to record in such a situation as this.
Indeed, sir, you are mistaken. I have not time nor paper sufficient to record all the interesting events and personages of the voyage, together with my own observations of them. Mr. Prettyman, for instance, his opinions are notorious.
Personages?
You must know that, had I not his lordship's direct instructions, I should still have been scribbling. It is my ambition to outgibbon Mr. Gibbon.
We may all be famous then. I had not looked for it.
That is for the future. His lordship has found himself temporarily vexed by the gout. It is my hope that a frank, though private, account of my travels may offer him some diversion.
The officers of the ship must bulk large in such an account.
Now, they are objects of the landsman's interest.
The captain particularly so?
You, sir? I had not considered that. But you are, after all, the king or emperor of our floating society, with prerogatives of justice and mercy. Yes, I suppose you do bulk large in my journal, and will continue to do so.
At which point he turned on his heel and walked away. There was no doubting the effect of my words. It was clear that the mention of my journal would force him to reconsider the whole Collie affair and his own cruel and unjust part in it. Surely my hint was strong enough. He would have to come down to see Collie for himself. And he did come down. Through the louvre of my own hutch, I saw him stand abrupt and grim in the centre of the lobby, interrogating the closed doors, almost as though daring anyone to see him there. Then he stepped to the door of Collie's hutch, and for a long minute stared through it. Then, with a movement that seemed to cry out, "I'll be damned if I will," he stumped to the ladder and disappeared. I felt certain that having seen the situation, he would come down again. But he did not. He sent his messenger.
Who is it?
Mr. Summers.
Come in. Sit down for a moment while I scan my journal.
Locked, I see.
It is not for everyone's eyes, Mr. Summers.
Mr. Talbot, it cannot be allowed to continue.
My journal, you mean?
I have looked in again on Collie by the captain's orders.
I looked in on him myself. I agreed to, you remember?
The man's reason is at stake.
Well, for a little drink. Is there still no change?
Phillips swears he has not moved for 3 days.
Time for him to rise again, then, surely.
I repeat, the man is losing his wits.
It does indeed seem so.
I am to do what I can by the captain's orders, and you are to assist me.
I?
You are not ordered to assist me, but I am ordered to invite your assistance and profit by your advice.
Oh, I saw the man is flattering me.
Captain Anderson feels that you have a social experience and awareness that may make your advice of value.
Come, Summers, he never said that.
No, sir, not precisely. Not
precisely, indeed. I suspect I could tell you what he did say or what he thought. But I will do what I can.
I was sure you would agree. You are co-opted among us ignorant tars of the civil power. What is to be done?
We should surely have co-opted Miss Granham. Being a canon's daughter, she might know how best to handle the clergy.
Be serious, sir, and leave her to Mr. Prettyman.
No, it cannot be. Minerva herself?
Mr. Collie must claim all our attention.
Well, then, here we have a clergyman who made too much of a beast of himself and refines desperately upon it.
You know what a beast he made of himself?
And I saw him. We all saw him, including the ladies.
And there, in the forecastle.
How can we tell?
We might ask.
Is that wise, Summers? Was not the play-acting of the common people directed at those in authority over them? We should avoid reminding them of that.
It is the man's wit, sir. Something must be risked. Who set him on? Beside the common people, there are the emigrants. Decent as far as I have met them. They have no wish to mock at authority, yet they must know something.
It's terrible, Summers, that they should have seen a clergyman in that state.
What's past cannot be helped, sir. For God's sake, make one more effort to rouse him from his lethargy.
Very well. For the second time, then. Oh, the stench. It's worse than the ship itself.
Here is Mr. Talbot. Mr. Colley, come to see you.
Well, Mr. Colley, this is an unfortunate business. But believe me, sir, you are refining too much upon it. Uncontrolled drunkenness is an experience every man should have at least once in his life, or how is he to understand the experience of others? As for your relieving nature on the deck, do but consider what those decks have seen in war. You are bound to Sydney Cove, I believe, and thence to Van Diemen's Land. Good Lord, Mr. Colley, from what I've heard, they are more likely to greet you there drunk than sober. What you need now is a dram, then as much ale as your stomach can hold. Depend upon it, you will soon see things differently.
Leave him, sir.
Well?
Mr. Colley is willing himself to death.
Oh, come on.
I have known it happen among savage peoples. They are able to lie down and die. And we have neither priest nor doctor.
Brocklebank, owned to having been a medical student for the best part of a year.
Did he so? Should we call him?
I forbid, he does prose on, sir.
I shall inquire among our people for it.
For a doctor?
For some information as to what happened.
Then we saw what happened.
I mean in the forecastle, or below it, rather than on deck.
He was made beastly drunk.
And was that all?
All.
I see. Well, sir, I shall report back to the captain.
Tell him I shall continue to consider how we may devise some method of bringing the wretched fellow to his senses.
I will do so, and must thank you for your assistance.
When Summers left and I returned to my journal, I couldn't help being amused at the thought of Prettyman and Miss Granham. There is a subject I must find out more about, if only for the entertainment of it. And then suddenly, without warning, a thought walked into my head. The manuscript I had seen on Collie's desk flap. I could swear that on my second visit it had not been there. I had to return to Collie's cabin.
I was right, it isn't there. But the man has not moved for 3 days. Or perhaps he has. Perhaps something I said on my first visit touched him in some way, deepening his pain, his anguish, so that he got up from his bed and... what? Tore up the papers? Obviously not. Or jammed them into some convenient crack where they could be concealed till doomsday. And yes, there is such a gap between the bunk and the side of the vessel. So I leaned across him and thrust my hand in and drew out a crumpled mass of sheets, all written and cross-written and all, I was certain, material evidence against our tyrant in the case of Collie versus Anderson. I put them into the bosom of my coat and quickly returned to my cabin, where I thrust them into my writing case and locked it as if I were concealing a burglary. Not a moment too soon.
Who is it?
Wheeler, sir. I have a message, sir. The captain requests that you give him the pleasure of your company at dinner in an hour's time.
My compliments to the captain, and I accept with pleasure.
I changed and dismissed Wheeler, only to find his place taken by Summers, who looked positively elegant.
Mr. Talbot.
Good God, Summers, are you also bidden to the feast?
I am to share that pleasure, and Old Meadow makes a fourth.
It still wants more than 10 minutes. What is the etiquette on shipboard?
Where the captain is concerned, on the last stroke of the bell.
In that case, I shall disappoint his expectations and arrive early. I'm sure he will expect me to be late.
The captain's cabin, though not as large as the saloon, was palatial compared with our meagre quarters. The after bulkhead was one vast leaded window through which almost a third of the horizon could be seen. Yet part of it was obscured by a row of climbing plants, twisting themselves round bamboos that rose from flower pots standing on the deck. The captain was watering his plants with a sort of small watering can you might find a lady using in an orangery.
Come in, Mr. Talbot. I must apologize for not greeting you at the threshold. You have caught me in my garden.
I did not know that you had a private paradise, Captain.
In which the flowers, at least, are so far unfallen.
That is the point of theology on which I cannot be sure, sir.
This plant is called the garland plant. The ancients, I am told, crowned themselves with it. The flower, when it appears, is agreeably perfumed and waxen white.
We might be Grecians, then, and crown ourselves for the feast.
I do not think the custom suited to the English. But do you see, I have three of them. Two I raised from seed.
Is that task as difficult as your triumphant tone would imply?
Sir Joseph Banks said it was impossible. Anderson, he said, take cuttings, man. You might as well throw the seeds overboard. But I have persevered, and in the end I had a box of them. Seedlings, I mean. What will you drink, sir? There's much to hand, though I take no more than an occasional glass myself.
Wine for me, sir.
Hawkins, the claret, if you please. This geranium, you see, Mr. Talbot, has some disease of the leaf. I have dusted it with flowers of sulphur, but to no effect. I shall lose it, no doubt. But then he who gardens at sea must accustom himself to loss. On my first command, I lost my whole collection.
Through the violence of the enemy?
No, sir. Through weeks without wind or rain, I could not have served water to my plants. There would have been mutiny. I see the loss of one plant, no great matter.
Your claret, sir?
Besides, you may exchange it for another at Sydney Cove.
That may be. We are a long way and a long time from our destination, Mr. Talbot.
You speak as if you do not anticipate our arrival with pleasure.
You are young, sir. You cannot understand the necessity of solitude to some natures. I would not care if the voyage lasted forever.
But surely a man is connected to society, to a family.
Family? Why should a man not do without a family? What is there about a family, pray?
A man is not a garland plant, Captain, to fertilize his own seed.
At least I may remind myself how remarkable the flora will be in the Antipodes.
Mr. Oldmeadow is here, sir.
Come in, gentlemen. What will you take, Mr. Oldmeadow? Mr. Talbot is content with the claret.
The sherry, I think, sir.
Summers, I had meant to ask you. How does your patient?
Still the same, sir. Mr. Talbot was kind enough to comply with your request, but his words had no greater effect than mine.
It is a sad business. I shall enter in the ship's log that the patient, for such I believe we must consider him, has been visited by you, Mr. Summers, and by you, Mr. Talbot.
Oh, but you must remember, sir, that if the wretched man is to be considered a patient, my opinion is valueless. I have no medical knowledge whatsoever. You would do better to consult Mr. Brocklebank.
Who is Brocklebank?
The artistic gentleman with the port wine face and female entourage. But I was joking. He told me he'd begun to study medicine, but had given up.
He has some medical experience, then?
No, the man is... Well, what is he, Summers? I doubt he could take a pulse.
Nevertheless, Hawkins, find Mr. Brocklebank and ask him to be good enough to come and see me.
Yes, sir.
It was now that I began to understand the captain's purpose in getting us all into his cabin. I saw it all. Saw the entry in the log, ending with visited by a gentleman of some medical experience. He was, as Deverell would say, keeping his yardarm free.
Mr. Brocklebank will be happy to wait on you, sir.
We will sit down, then. Mr. Talbot, to my right. Mr. Oldmeadow, here, sir, and Summers. We'll take the bottom of the table. He must have plenty of room to allow him free passage through the door in case one of 10,000 affairs takes him about the ship's business.
The soup is excellent.
Much nonsense is talked about Navy food. You may depend upon it. Where food has to be ordered, stored, and served by the thousands of tons, there will be cause of complaint here and there. But in the main, British seamen eat better at sea than they do ashore.
Bravo, Summers. You ought to be on the government benches.
Glass of wine with you, Mr. Summers.
Thank you, sir.
But what do you say to the story of the cheese clapped on the main as a mast capping and the snuff boxes carved out of beef?
And the bones we near ourselves to our gallant tars with no more than a dried shred of meat adhering?
I fancy we'll sample the cheese, sir. And I believe the captain is about to surprise you with the bones.
Indeed I am. Hawkins, have them brought in.
Yes, sir.
Good God, marrow bones.
Ah, Bessie, I suppose. It's a very profitable beef.
We are overwhelmed, sir. Lucullus could do no better.
I am endeavouring to supply you with material for your journal, Mr.
I give you my word, sir, the menu shall be preserved for posterity together with a memorial of the captain's hospitality.
The gentleman is at the door.
Ah, Brocklebank. If you will excuse me, gentlemen, I will take him for a moment into the office.
Thank you, thank you. Oh, marrow bones.
How the devil did you know, sir? One of my girls told you, I suppose. This must be my glass. Confusion to the French. Now then, I shall get to work on this. Don't just stand there, Summers. Sit down.
Ah, yes. Mr. Summers, pull up that chair and dine with us, please. Now, Mr. Brocklebank, may we profit from your medical experience?
May what?
Mr. Talbot. Mr. Talbot
what
here.
What the devil's wrong with him? Good God! I assure you that Zenobia, dear, warm-hearted girl...
I myself have nothing to do with the present matter. Our captain refers to Collie.
The parson? Is it? Oh, good God. I assure you, it don't matter to me at my time of life. Let them enjoy themselves, I said. On board, I said. Or did
we
I?
We need your medical experience. We have none ourselves, and look to you.
I have none either.
Mr. Talbot said...
I looked round, you see, and I said, Wilmot, I said, this anatomy is not for you. You don't have the stomach for it. So I abandoned Aesculapius for the muse. Have I not said so to you, Mr. Dalton?
On at least two occasions, sir. I have no doubt the captain will accept your excuses.
No, no. However little this gentleman's experience, we must profit by it.
Profit? There's more profit in the muse than any other thing. I should be a rich man now, had not the warmth of the constitution, and the attachment more than usually warm to the sex, and the opportunities for excess forced on me nature by the shocking corruption of English society.
I could not abide doctoring. All those corpses.
Did you know I was the first in the field after the death of Lord Nelson with a lithograph portraying the happy occasion?
You were not present.
Neither was any other artist. I must admit to you freely that I believed at the time that Lord Nelson had expired on death.
Brocklebank, I have seen it. There is a copy on the wall of the tap with the dog and gun.
It is so very well, Mr. Talbot. I cannot conceal from you that without the continuing popularity of that work, I should be in Queer Street. It has allowed me to take passage to wherever it is we're going. The fact is, Lord Nelson died below in some stinking bilge with nothing to see him by but a ship's lantern. And who the devil's going to make a picture out of that?
Rembrandt, perhaps?
Rembrandt! but at least, Mr. Talbot, you must admire the dexterity of my management of smoke.
Take me with you, sir.
Smoke, sir, is the very devil. Did you not see it when Summers fired me gun? With a broadside, a naval battle is nothing more than a London fog.
Mr. Brocklebank.
So your true craftsman must tuck it away to where it does not obtrude.
Like a clown.
On the necessary business. I beg your pardon. As the epitaph says, where'er you be, let your wind go free. For holding mine was the death of me.
I think, sir, that Mr. Brocklebank might...
That's where the smoke comes in. By the time I've done my first layout, the frigate will have just fired, and the smoke will have risen around her. And the sloop, which will have been in the hands of some obscure lieutenant, will be lucky to appear at all.
Mr. Summers, sir.
I am called for, sir.
You are fortunate, Mr. Summers.
My client's ship, on the other hand, will be belching more fire than smoke and will be attacked on all sides by all the enemy at once.
I could almost wish that the French would afford us the opportunity for invoking the good offices of your brush.
There is no hope of that, no hope at all.
My most successful client, apart from the late Lord Nelson, if I may so describe him, he said... Could you not dash me in there, Brocklebank, just by the broken rail, encouraging me crew by indicating the enemy by waving me sword towards them? The figure will be very small, Sir Samuel, I said. That is of no consequence, he said. You may exaggerate me a little. If I do that, Sir Samuel, I said, I will reduce your frigate to a sloop by contrast. Well, then, you must dash me in small, he said. They'll know me by me cocked hat and me epaulettes.
Sir Samuel, did you say Sir Samuel?
Yeah, I did, sir, I did. Do we move on to the brandy?
I know him or knew him.
Oh, tell us all, Captain.
I was the lieutenant commanding the sloop, but I have not seen the picture.
So you were in the thick of the battle, were you not?
In a sloop, against frigates.
But Captain Samuel must have thought me a young fool, for he called me that, bawling through his speaking trumpet. Get the hell out of this, you young fool, or I'll have you broke.
I drink to you, sir. I must limb you, Captain, at a reduced fee. Your future career...
Career? Don't you understand, you damn fool? The war is nigh over and done with, and we are for the beach, every man jack of us.
Sir, I have been with Mr. Colley, sir. It is my belief the man is dead.
Gentlemen, this sorry affair must end our meeting.
Of course.
Hawkins, have Mr. Brocklebank escorted to his cabin.
Excellent dinner, sir. Fine bones.
Mr. Talbot, Mr. Oldmeadow, be good enough to view the body with Mr. Summers to confirm his opinion. I will do so myself. I fear his intemperance has destroyed him.
Intemperance, sir? A single unlucky indulgence.
What do you mean, Mr. Talbot?
You will enter it so in the law.
That is something for me to consider in my own time, Mr. Talbot.
It seemed that every passenger in the after part of the ship was congregated in the lobby and staring silently at Collie's door. Wheeler was standing on guard, though Phillips is Collie's man. And it was Wheeler who ushered the captain in. He stayed no more than a moment.
Mr. Talbot, if you please.
I went in with no great willingness. The poor man still clutched the ring bolt, with his face pressed against the bolster. I put three fingers on his cheek and whipped them back again as if burned. I did not need to listen for his breathing.
Mr. Oldmeadow?
Well,
Mr. Talbot.
No living thing could be that cold.
I'm so sorry.
Captain Oldmeadow has fainted, sir.
Get his head on his knees, Wheeler, and then take him out for salute. Terribly sorry.
I know you all. I am an artist.
God, Brocklebank.
The man is not dead, but sleepeth. He is in low fever and may be recovered by a
come
drink.
Come on, Nigel, fella, back to your bucket.
In the low fever.
What the devil is a low fever? Now go in, I said. Mrs. Brocklebank, Miss Brocklebank, I appeal to
come
you.
Come back in, Pa.
Well, gentlemen.
There is no doubt the man is dead.
I heard mention of a low fever.
That was Brocklebank, sir, and he is not wholly himself.
Nevertheless, Mr. Brocklebank has some medical experience. Mr. Summers,
see that the customary arrangements are made.
Aye, aye, sir.
Mr. Taylor!
Aye, sir.
Bring aft the sailmaker and his mate, and three or four able-bodied men. You may take what men of the off-duty watch who are under punishment.
Aye, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, you will not wish to witness what follows. May I request the lobby be cleared? The air of the afterdeck is to be recommended.
A low fever, gentlemen, is the opposite to a high fever. Good day.
Pa, come back in.
And you, Mr. Talbot?
I have the captain's request still to comply with.
That task is ended, I fancy, with the man's death.
And I believe I have found the word you set me to discover. It is justice.
You have decided who is to appear at the bar?
Have not you?
Here is the sailmaker. I recommend the afterdeck.
A glass of brandy will be more appropriate. I went to the passenger saloon and found Oldmeadow slumped there on the stern window seat, an empty glass in his hand. Well, is this how you behave on a stricken field, Oldmeadow? Forgive me. I'm not myself either.
The truth is, I've never seen a stricken field, nor heard a shot fired in anger, except once, when my adversary missed me by a yard.
All will be done soon.
I wear the king's uniform, yet I've never before seen a dead body, except, I believe, what, the occasional tarred object in chains.
Presently Summers came in, and behind him I glimpsed a party of men bearing a covered object away along the deck.
A brandy for you, Summers.
The after deck and a breath of air for me, I think. Is it? Damn silly of me, it was.
Drink that down, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Talbot.
You mentioned justice.
Well, sir?
You keep a journal.
And?
Just that.
He nodded meaningfully at me, finished his brandy, and left. But he does not know what I have already written. In these papers, I have accused the captain of an abuse of power, and have let stand Summer's suggestion that I myself am to some extent responsible. But now, the case is altered. A man, a civilian, is dead at sea, and Captain Anderson must give some account of what happened. And yet, the fact is, we still do not know what happened. It is time for me to read the one piece of material evidence so far unexplored. James Colley's manuscript.
In episode 2 of Rites of Passage by William Golding, Talbot was played by Samuel West, Parson Colley by Simon Russell Beale, and Captain Anderson by Kenneth Haig. Lieutenant Summers was Barnaby Kay, Cumbersham, Struan Roger, Deverell, Roger May, Wheeler, John Grillo, Brocklebank, George Marcel, Zenobia, Lucy Tregear, Miss Granham, Alison Skilbeck, Prettyman, Phillips and Hawkins, Max Digby, Bates and Old Meadow, Charles Edwards, Billy Rogers, Richard Lang, and Mr. Taylor, Julian Morris. Rites of Passage was adapted for radio and directed by Don Taylor and was an independent production by First Rights Radio, or BBC Radio 4.